And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 25th, 2020. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you, Ted? So today we're going to be talking about pregnancy and climate pollution and how it disproportionately affects minority women. And then we'll be diving into donut economics and then the economics of well-being and what coronavirus has taught us about that. So I think it's going to be a good show.
Good to hear. So there's an interesting article that dovetails with a lot of the stuff we've been talking about recently and kind of puts a case in point, right? An example, case in point. There was an article in the New York Times that basically made the case based, I think, on what's called a meta study, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. A meta study is when people take other research papers and kind of collect the data, compare how good the data is in different, you know, how comparable the stuff is and try and draw larger conclusions. And they looked at 32 million pregnant women, you know, used in these studies in the United States over the last 10 or 15 years, 32 million women. And they determined that climate change is a risk to pregnant women and their babies in the sense that I think that I've got the actual quote here somewhere, but like every 1 degree above normal temperature, the local temperature is like in your city, right? If it's 1 degree warmer, then the risk of a preterm birth goes up by 10% or something, right? Is that the case? Mariah, tell me, what was the story with the whole question of risk from climate change or high temperatures to pregnant women?
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about, on this show, we've talked a lot about how minority communities are disproportionately affected by climate change, in large part because there are, a lot of the fossil fuel pollution dumping entities are sited in near minority communities. But this was an interesting study, just diving into pregnant women, and it's really crushing. As you said, it's every temperature increase of 1 degree Celsius in the week before delivery corresponded with a 6% greater likelihood of stillbirth between May and September, which is just shocking, right? I know, you know, I'm a mother. I have children. I was pregnant, obviously, I was pregnant. And I remember that time and just being so concerned about everything I was doing and was it harming my baby? And, you know, it's a tough time for any mother, but to have these additional factors threatening the safety and health of you and your baby, I just can't even imagine. The other thing they talk about is ozone, or also known as smog, and tiny particles called PM2.5, so the particulate matter, are also affecting. They're associated with preterm births, low birth weights, and stillbirths. The research found that high exposure to air pollution during the final trimester of pregnancy was linked to a 42% increase in the risk of stillbirths. So these are really shocking, just awful statistics.
Right. It sounds as if there were things that you would say, yeah, that probably is bad for a pregnant woman to be exposed to, you know, excess pollution. Right. So, yeah, I'll give you that's bad. The shocking part is that it's primarily women of color that are thus exposed, right, because of racial injustices. Right. That's how it works out. That it ends up the threat is to these communities.
Yeah. In fact, there's a woman cited in this article who named Catherine Garcia Flower. She's a field organizer in Houston for Moms Clean Air Force. So Clean Air Force is a fantastic organization that's, you know, organizing around health issues for moms, obviously. But she says doing nothing for pollution, doing nothing about air pollution, which so clearly has a greater impact on Black Americans, is racism in action. It's a really bold statement, and I think an important one. If you are not trying to stop air pollution, you're basically saying it's okay with me that other people, you know, are going to die because of this, right?
Right,
and that's a form of racism, because it's not you that might die, maybe, perhaps, right? It's someone else that's going to die, and that's more remote from you, so it's not concerning to you. I mean, you know, that's not always the case, of course, but that's kind of what she's getting at there.
And that's the sort of the kernel, one of the many kernels of very useful insight from our current discussion about this, is that you can consider yourself not at all a racist, pat yourself on the back, but you're happy to participate in a system where people of color are exposed to these things, right? You do nothing about it. It's basically what you're saying, right? If you do nothing about it, then you are part of the system that is causing that, full stop, right? Even though you're in your own heart, you probably would never force someone to do that. But yeah, we're all built into this systemic thing. And this is the exposure to communities of color is, I mean, there was a quote I saw, I think it was in a related article, but it said that, I think I got the quote right, 68% of people of color live within 30 miles of a power plant.
Wow.
Right? It's like, holy mackerel. Yeah. I mean, that again speaks to nothing that people of goodwill have ever planned, but people of goodwill allow to happen, right? And there you go. Yeah. So now you're locked in.
Right. And this article talks about how living, you know, closer to, it says a plant that uses garbage to produce energy specifically, it increases the risk of low birth weight by 3%. So
Right. I mean, there you go. Yeah. I mean, it's, so I think that the point for me is to again link the question of systemic, not personal, but system built in racism, but to climate change. And that I think the argument that's in my head is that when we solve the issue of climate change and systemic racism, we will have thoroughly solved the problem of climate change, right? And that, I mean, that one marker of how well you're doing is when Black women are not exposed to, you know, pregnant Black women are not exposed to these excess risks, right? That's when you know you're making progress. And I think that's a good, I mean, I hope that's a good way to think about it. And
yeah, you know, it reminds me of some, one of my favorite authors, Kate Raworth, who talks about donut economics, which is this, you know, idea that, you know, basically we want to have a future that is established for every person's needs while safeguarding the living world on which we depend. So there, if you picture a donut, on the inside ring is the sort of the social foundation, which is where, you know, if you fall into that circle in the inside of the ring, you are lacking life's essentials such as food, education, housing, health, all of those things, right? And on the outside of the donut is the ecological ceiling. So there's an overshoot of pressure on Earth's life-giving systems, and such as climate change, ozone layer depletion, air pollution. And so the sweet spot is in between those two things, right? So creating a society where we are both, you know, the social we don't fall into the donut hole, into the center of the donut, because we've created a society where we're supporting, you know, equal access to water, food, health, education, income and work, peace and justice, social equity, gender equality for everyone. But we also don't overshoot the resource availability we have and go outside of the donut. So it's a really interesting concept.
I mean, so just so I stay with this, is a graphical image you're saying, right? And there's basically a Dunkin' Donut on it, and in the middle of the Dunkin' Donut is the place where you don't have enough to eat. On the outside of the Dunkin' Donut is where you've taxed the environment, and what you want to do is find life in the nice doughy part of the honeydew donut, right? That's where you're balancing the right. I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, I understand that is a philosophy that has a lot of support, right? Raworth, I mean, she's from England, right?
Yeah, she is. She's from England. In fact, I mean, it certainly has a lot of support. I mean, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals in 2015 basically said that they want this to happen. That this is one of their goals for society, for the world, is to get here, and they want to have that achieved by 2030. So it's mm-hmm. it's not It's not so pie in the sky. It's an official goal of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. It's one of the official goals of them, of that organization.
So tell me, how does that – so one of the things that has popped up recently is the – I'm not sure it's a buzzword or exactly what, but it's something called the well-being economy. Have you followed – I mean, what – how does that – I mean, it must relate to the – this sort of donut economy, which again are all sort of these mental images of how to think about the way the world works, right? But the well-being economy seems. Well, tell me, have you seen anything on that lately? What's the?
I'm very excited about that. In fact, there's an article. There's an article that was published in Climate Home News called Coronavirus Shows Why We Need an Economy Designed for Well-Being. And I actually, Naomi Klein has written a lot about the caring economy and all these other things. But this article that she wrote about the caring economy in her book, This Changes Everything, which is a fantastic book. But this article in the Climate Home News talks about how the pandemic has really forced us to take a step back and look at what's really important to us. And before the pandemic, it says we were working too hard and sacrificing public space to private cars. And so the idea of looking and figuring out what it is that we really need to satisfy our needs, but making sure that everyone has a decent standard of living is, and we're living inside the environmental limits of our planet, is sort of, they're saying, look, you know, we're at the point where we know what those things are. We know what it is that we really, truly need. And that's how we should be moving forward post-pandemic.
Well, I was intrigued because I read the article as well. And it the thing I took away was the statement that humans, society, so this is probably Western developed societies, right? That we confuse the means and the ends and that everybody wants to be happy. But we confuse that with the means to the end, which is having a high-paying job and having a shiny car and all these sort of things that we're doing to make ourselves happy. And I think what the author was saying was basically we should short-circuit this and talk about how do we be happy without having to chase all these techniques, right, of working too long and being, you know, we all have to give up space to the cars because we all got to go to work so we can make money so we can be happy. But we never actually get happy because we're spending too much time in our car, right?
Yeah, and too much time at work and not enough time, you know, with friends or with family or with community, exactly. One of the things it talks about is, I think this is fascinating, right? This idea that our focus is on increasing GDP, right? And I think there's Bhutan, right? Has they measure success by gross national happiness. You know, is every member of our country happy? Then we're successful. And here we are saying, well, you know, are we making more stuff? Are we producing more things? Are we making more money? Then we're successful. And I think that's a whole topic probably for another podcast.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. Well, especially given coming out of the pandemic thing was, you know, it's almost becoming in the rearview mirror now, right? Because we're all opening up, blah, blah, blah. But it was this moment where everyone sort of looked around and you say, wait a minute, what are we doing? Right. The article. So I saw an article, it might be related, but in Scotland, the country of Scotland has issued a report about the well-being economy and how this is their plan to get there. And what their argument, or at least one of the lines, right, was that the people's welfare should be agnostic about the state of the economy. Right. That is to say, agnostic meaning not knowing. Right. Doesn't care. People should be happy whether the economy is good or bad. And we shouldn't set up a world where the economy is when the economy goes bad, everything is people's lives are bad. Right. That sounds pie in the sky, but it's not if you take away the GDP as the holy grail that we must all pursue all the time. Right. There's different ways to make a human life that is satisfying and well-meaning without being in, you know, the proverbial rat race. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot to sort of unpack there. I, it's a hard balance too, to sort like to say that the economy doesn't matter. I get that that's, you know, to a lot of people, of course it really does, right? You know, if the economy collapses, we are in that process of seeing how many people are affected by that. But at the same time, I think it's an interesting thought experiment to see what happens if we value things in a different way. If we put priorities on things in a different way. How does, what are the follow-on effects of that?
I saw a discussion somewhere that talked about the language that we use to talk about the economy is very telling, right? That what you'll see on the news is that the economy is ailing, right? The economy is sick. The economy, you know, is overheated. All these sort of organic things that put humans in service of the economy, that we all have to do stuff to get the economy going again, right? When in fact, the economy exists to service people's needs, right? It's a reversal, right? I'm not here to make sure that the economy is healthy all the time, right? That's not, the economy is supposed to be serving me somehow. And we get, and I think it went beyond, the discussion I heard went beyond that. Like, there are certain people that talk about the economy as an organic thing that's either healthy or unhealthy. We need to take care of it. And I think the other wing talks about the economy as something that you can tune up like a car. Like it's just a mechanical thing that you need to fix. It's not this, as I say, organic existential being that floats around on CNBC that we're all in service of. And so I guess I can't go much beyond that, but the language that we use to describe the economy tells us a lot about what we think the economy. And of course, the economy is important because that's where all the fossil fuels are being used, and that's where people's happiness is generated or not. So that's right. So
Yeah, and over focus on the economy can lead us to make bad decisions that affect the health of many people, both with climate change and with COVID, as we have seen.
right. And
Certainly
I
in this
mean,
administration.
and the economy that is, so then you're all the way back to kind of racism and white supremacy. Economy that's centered around extraction and disposable people, as we talked about in the past podcast, right? Again, you're back to the economy is more real than the people who are chewed up by it, which is not any place any of us want to be, right? Wow. We want to want to, too bad. Now you're more of an economist than I am, so I'm gonna. But I guess I'm just gonna say I only play an economist on a podcast. I get to say these things
Here.
because why do I get to say that? I suppose it's First Amendment free speech, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? But I will say again, I'll recommend Kate Raworth's book, because she is an economist, and her and it's you know that the book Donut Economics is really eye-opening.
That's the
Race
name,
and an
Donut
Economist.
Economics, right?
It is called Donut Economics. Yep.
By Kate
It's
Raworth.
7 ways to think like a 21st century economist. And it's Raworth. Great book.
All right. We will put up links. Believe it or not, I bet you're surprised I'm going to say this, but we will put those links in the blog, which will be at the MCAN blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. Nota bene, all dear listeners. If you go through something like Podbean, you're not going to get the hot links. You need to go to the MCAN website to get the hot links to the donut economy. If you want, please send an email with your what flavor of donut economy you want to build, whether it's a jelly, the Bavarian cream, the Krispy Kreme. Send that email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. You can listen to this show on the distribution app you're listening to now, but you can get it on all the other ones. We are agnostic when it comes to podcast distribution apps. We want to thank DR Tucker for his continuing research support. Always sets us on the right path. And we want to close the way we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a plan that is just and equitable in all of the senses that we have been discussing, that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.